We'll figure all of that out another time. Right, so where we had left off, I believe, was a dividing our subject of a the war with Amalek, dividing it essentially up into three parts. The introduction, just to kind of look at the beginning of the perek with Shaul and Amalek and kind of identify some of the problems. Then we went backwards. We went to Chumash and the two parashiyot of Amalek in the Torah, specifically in Parashat B'Shalach and in Parashat Ki Tetzeh, the story of Amalek, the battle of Amalek, and the description of Parashat Zachar. We talked about the contradiction or the seeming contradiction between the two and suggested as an approach to balance the two, one which conveys the notion that Amalek, that the issue of Amalek is a kind of a theological one. Amalek's war with Israel is really a war against God, and therefore it's God's battle, if you will, Mechamah LaHashem ba'Amalek, and that the crime is a crime against some kind of a spiritual crime of against God. The other flip side is the description of Amalek in Parashat Zachar, which places the emphasis on the moral depravity of Amalek, on the methodology of how Amalek attacked, picking on the weak and the stragglers, that it was a kind of a moral, ethical issue with Amalek, and therefore it's our responsibility to take revenge against Amalek. We showed the epicenter of the machloket in the way the mitzvah is formulated in Parashat B'Shalach. Macha emched zech Amalek. I will destroy Amalek, says God, because milchama laHashem ba'Amalek m'dador. Versus the psukim in Zachar, which describe the mandate to us, timcheh et zech Amalek, our responsibility to engage and destroy Amalek. We had suggested a possible katuv hashlishi emachmir b'neihem, a kind of a pshara or a compromise between the two, which was to look at Amalek historically. We went to a third source altogether, namely the story of Amalek at the end of Sefer Shmuel, where we again find the battle of Amalek, this time by David. The context of that battle being the war, the attack of Amalek against the city of Tziklag. Tziklag is David's hometown as he's living amongst the Plishtim. Tziklag is where the women and children are there while David takes the soldiers to go off with Achish Melech Gat together with the Plishtim to fight against Shaul. Gets out of the ethical dilemma because the Plishtim don't trust him, so they send him home. By the time he gets home, he realizes that Amalek had attacked the village and had captured all the women and children, and didn't kill them, but rather captured them to take them south towards Mitzrayim. And we find David chasing them all the way down to Mitzrayim, where they find an Eved, a Na'ar Mitzri, Eved, the Amalek. We find the Na'ar Mitzri, an Egyptian, a slave to Amalek, recognizing that that seems to be the context of Amalek. They seem to be engaged in the process of capturing people and taking them down to Mitzrayim to engage in commerce, the slave trade. Nomadic tribes, from what do they derive their livelihood? They're not farmers and they're not shepherds. What are they? They're slave traders. And they capture innocent, they capture women and children and sell them as slaves. That's what they do. And so that would explain their attack on Israel in the aftermath of Yitzhak Mitzrayim, in Rephidim, where Moshe and the elders and the Zkenim and Yeshua and all the leaders are off finding water in Har Chorev, comes along Amalek and says, oh, perfect opportunity to attack, capture some of the people and send them back to Mitzrayim as slaves. After all, they're a bunch of renegade slaves that don't really belong here anyway. They call themselves a nation, they're really slaves. We're going to sell them back as slaves and make some money off the deal. And in that moment where you see Amalek engaging the attack in Israel, which is a moral and ethical issue of their attack in terms of the method, you also understand why the Torah in B'Shalach places the emphasis on the frame of reference of Yetziat Mitzrayim. for them to come to attack Israel and say, we're going to send you back to Mitzrayim, is to undermine the essence of Yitzhak Mitzrayim. This is Parashat B'Shalach. They just left Egypt. They just engaged in Kriyat Yam Suf. The whole world is marveling at Yitzhak Mitzrayim. Comes along Amalek and says, we're going to send you back to Mitzrayim. So on a certain level, there is a theology there that says they're undermining the essence of our relationship with God, namely Yitzhak Mitzrayim. But methodologically, they are slave traders. And that's what they do. They engage in the sale of Israel as slaves. So those two parshiot together gives us a broader picture of what Amalek is. Rather than seeing them as this strong nation that is kind of a battlefield between Mitzrayim and Israel and battling on a theological level whose God is stronger, to see them as a much more primitive, if you will, nomadic tribes traveling through the desert, trying to feed off the innocent and sell them as slaves on the largest slave trade that they can get their hands on. That we will come back to that thesis much later when we look at Shaul and his effort against Amalek and why it was necessary for Shaul as a king to engage Amalek, because they really are nomadic tribes spread out throughout the south, and why Malchus, therefore, was so critical for that process. So I'm going to park all of that on the side. That's a kind of a brief overview of where we were at up until now. Questions? No? All good?
Well, the question that I have, you know, when you taught us this last time we met, it surprised me that Chazal never emphasized that they are slave traders, and that is the whole Chumash is against slavery, and it tries to moderate it, tries to manage it, you know, among the Jewish people, and even a woman who's captured from an enemy, she's not allowed to be treated as you wish.
Right.
So that comes along. A strong statement in the Chumash.
Right, and comes along Amalek, the antithetical. Right. So Chazal do talk about Amalek as a kind of antithetical nation that is exactly the mirror opposite of everything we stand for. Yeah. That Chazal do say. The whole battle against Amalek is described in terms of Amalek, Reshita Goyim Amalek, that they're the first nation, the same way Israel is called Reshit, that they're the mirror image, the opposite of us, and that there's Mechamal Hashem b'Amalek. The notion that until Amalek, which represents sense pure evil, is eradicated, we don't really find our place in the world. They're philosophically opposite worldviews. So it could be that that's exactly it. We emerge from slavery as a statement against mistreatment of others in slavery, and Amalek's modus operandi is to mistreat others to sell them as slaves. That's exactly the mirror image of the two.
Yeah, but it's a battle that continued for many years.
Shaul's dealing with it today, but yeah.
Right.
Up until today. What I want to do today is just to make life a little more difficult for us, because that's what we do. I want to take a broader step back and deal with probably the most difficult question in the battle, in the whole context of the Battle of Amalek. It's a question that is difficult in understanding Amalek. It's a question that's difficult in understanding the war with the Amekna'an. It really cuts to the core of the question of the Torah's the morality of the Torah's mandate of the conquest of Israel. It's a relevant question to the study of Sefer Yehoshua. It's a relevant question to the study of Sefer Shoftim. But nowhere does the question, to use a very sophisticated word, nowhere does the question irk us more than with Amalek. Because here's the Torah's mandate to Shaul from the Navi, go and kill every last man, woman, and child, me'ish v'yad isha, me'olel v'yad yonek, me'shor v'yad asel, me'chamor v'yad gamal. And you read that sentence as the mandate to Shaul. Put it in these terms. The mandate to Shaul reads very much like and reminiscent of another mandate related to Amalek, and that's the Gezerah of Haman, What was the gzeira of Haman? And what was the terminology of the decree of Haman? L'hashmid, l'arog u'l'abed, et kol ha'yehudim, mina'a v'yad zaken, taf v'nashim, v'yom achad u'shtalam l'avoz.
And they made such a point at the end of the Megillah to say that Jews did not take any...
Right, so we're going to address the spoils issue separately as a separate shiur, because that's a major issue here, that they do take the spoils, and how that fits in. Right, there are those who suggest that that too is part of the chet of Shaul, that he took of the spoils. On the other hand, open parentheses, when David fights Amalek in Perek Lamed, they do take the spoils, and there's nothing wrong with it. So, again, just to add a level of complexity, Shaul is not allowed to take the spoils, David is. Where does that distinction come from? But the morality of the command to destroy Amalek is a subject we need to address head on. So you can't get to the story of Shaul and his battle with Amalek without addressing the broadest question first, which is, how do we live with, how do we sleep at night with a command on the books, from our perspective, that reads like the genocidal statement of Haman? And that's a problematic statement. So I want to address this question first. For those, we did not study Yehoshua on the Wednesday night group. We did Yehoshua. I keep after reminding myself that Yehoshua we did Monday morning, but not Wednesday night. But we did touch on this a little bit in Sefer Shoftim. So sort of a review of some of what we discussed there. Nonetheless, I think it's relevant here, and it really needs to be addressed. So there's a series of commands in the Torah when it comes to battle and conquest that all share the same tenor, with the same kind of basic message. So the formulation here by Amalek, let's just turn quickly to Perek Tetvav. Read a couple of psukim in Sefer Shmuel, because that's what we're learning. Starting Perek Tetvav, Pasuk Bet. Koma Hashem Tzvaot, this is Shmuel speaking to Shaul. Koma Hashem Tzvaot, Bakadati et Asher Asa Amalek L'Yisrael. I remember, or I hold accountable, that which Amalek did to Israel. Asher samlo baderech ba'alotom mitzrayim. Who came and attacked him, or laid wait for him along the way as they left Egypt. Ata lech vikitat Amalek. Go and fight against Amalek. V'hacharamtem et kol asher lo. L'hachrim means to destroy. Destroy all that is theirs. V'lo tachmol alav, without compassion. V'himata mi'ish ad isha, mi'olel v'ad yonek, mi'shor v'ad esem, mi'gamal v'ad chamo. And to kill from man to woman to child, to from suckling child to mi'olel v'ad yonek, from small child to suckling, mi'shor v'ad esem, from ox to sheep, mi'gamal v'ad chamo. So these are phrases that we are familiar with, although that's exactly the issue. So it says, "Vahacharamtem." This one's not going to work. Vahacharamtem to destroy. Miish. Ve'ad isha me'olel ve'ad yonek. Man, woman, and child. I'll leave the animals out of it. Well, the animals don't bother me as much anymore. If I can resolve the issue of men, women, and children, I can live with the animals. Me'ish ve'ad isha me'olel ve'ad yonek. Another expression used in the context of Amalek, which is very similar and needs to be understood, is the expression that we find in the Torah, which is
Limchot.
Limchot. Timche et zecher Amalek mitachat Hashemayim. Timche, limchot, to destroy. Lahachrim, to obliterate. Sounds very similar to Lahashmid, Larok, Labed, et kol ha-yudim, minav, yad, zakeh, mitachat, nashim, v'yom achat. The phraseology, different terms, Lahachrim, limchot, mi'ish v'yadisha, makes me nervous. To see terminology like that against another nation makes me nervous. Anybody else share my nervousness? I don't know, but this is not the only place we find such language. The other place we find such language is in the very mandate of the command of the mitzvah of Kibush Haaretz. By Yehoshua, and earlier in Chumash, when the Torah describes the nature of how we are instructed to come into the land of Canaan and to fight. And there too we find this kind of language. So, in that sense, it becomes an extension. This is all vis-a-vis Amalek, vis-a-vis Amek Canaan. We have a similar kind of language. If you open up to Devarim Perek Chaf, Parashat Shoftim, actually, right?
Yeah.
Pasuk Yud. Ki tikrav al ir lehilachem aleh. When you approach a city, this paragraph is going to be the subject of our discussion today. So we're going to get here, we're going to stay here for a little while. Ki tikrav al ir lehilachem aleh. You approach, talking to the nation of Israel, to the army of Israel, God's, Moshe speaking to Bnei Israel, God, instruction. Approach a city to wage war against it. Which means, you do what is a good, moral, ethical thing to do, which is, you first give them the option of peace. If they answer you and they give with an offer of peace, meaning you extend your hand, the hand of peace, and they respond. Ufat chalach, right, they open up to you. Then the nations that are there will pay tribute, taxes, which is another way of saying they'll be, they have to, they can make peace with you, but they cannot prevent you from providing your sovereignty over the land. Right? You're the sovereign nation. They will remain, they'll have to pay their taxes or tribute to mas, avaducha, recognize your loyalty. It goes beyond that, beyond that which is not written in the text, but is understood, that they have to accept the Sheva Mitzvot Bnei Noach, they have to accept the seven Noahide laws, they have to accept a basic code of morality and ethics, and they have to live in the land as what we would call good citizens. Okay. V'im lo tashlimimach, what if they don't make peace with you? And instead of patchalach, instead of opening up to you with peace, they come to you in war. What should you do then? Says the Torah. Vitzarta'aleh means?
Besiege it.
You're fighting a city. They're strong. They have army. They have walls, ostensibly, soon. Right? So the first thing you do is you wage war, you besiege the city. If you besiege the city and God gives them over into your hands, all the males you may kill by the sword. Meaning, the term male here refers to not just male in terms of male versus female, but
military.
Meaning it's the combatants, you're fighting a war, they fight, you fight back, and they're fair game. However, rak hanashim v'ataf v'habehima v'chol asheyeh ba'ir kol shlala tavoz lach. When it comes to the women and the children and the animals and the spoils of war, that's fair game. That's spoils of war. but not lefi charev. That's just the zechura, the zachar lefi charev, and the nashim v'tafa beima are part of the spoils of war. V'chatad shlo levecha, you're allowed to take of the spoils of your enemy. Shenatan lecha Hashem elokecha. Lach. So far, formulation of biblical arena of battle, this war, there's the spoils of war, spoils to the victor. I can live with that. And then the Torah puts a caveat in all of this and says, Kein ta'aseh l'chol ha'arim ha'rechokot mimcha me'od. That's relevant to all of the cities and all of the nations that are far away, remote. Why? Asher lo me'areh ha'goyim e'elehina. We're not part of the Ameknan. They're not locals. That's true with faraway nations. Everything that we've said up until now, relevant to foreign nations. You're fighting against Assyria, Aram, a city in who knows where Saudi Arabia, Midian. Then everything that we've described up until now is relevant. Whereas, Rak me'areha amim ha'ela asher Hashem elokecha neten lecha nachala, when it comes to these cities which God has given, these nations which God has given to you as an inheritance, meaning the nations of Kna'an, lo t'chaye kol nishama. I will say it again. Lo t'chaye kol nishama. No soul is left alive. Ki hacharim tacharimem. You must destroy them. Hachitiv, and just in case we weren't sure who it's talking about, hachitiv ha'amori ha'knani ha'prizi ha'chivi ha'yevusi. That's the six of the seven. There's always that seventh one that appears sometimes and not other places, Girgashi, which appears in some sources. Kasher tzivcha Hashem elokeh. Why do you need to obliterate the nations that are there? Leman asher lo yilamdu etchem lasot kol ha'tovatam asher asu l'elohem v'chatatem Hashem elokechem. So that they do not have an influence on you to teach you their ways of idolatry and lead you astray. So, what do I have? When it comes to Ameknan, I have two more expressions that appear specifically with regards to Ameknan, namely, Acharem Tacharimem, which is essentially the same as the mitzvah given to Amalek, Tishul about Amalek, Vacharimtem, Acharem Tacharimem, and the more plaguing expression of Lo Techaye Kol Nishama. And specifically with regards to other nations, it says Kshura Lefichareb, the males by the sword, and the Nashim Vataf are part of the Bizar, part of the spoils. Whereas with Ameknan, Lo Techaye Kol Nishama. And by the comparison, I assume that Lo Techaye Kol Nishama refers to the Nashim and the Taf, because that's what's part of the Bizar with regards to other nations, is in contrast to Ameknan, Lo Techaye Kol Nishama. This is a very problematic expression. This expression is so problematic that it has become the source of a great polemic in Israel today. And there's a whole sector of Israel, society in Israel, that is so uncomfortable with the phraseology and expressions of conquest related to Sefer Yoshua, and this is a prelude to Sefer Yoshua, that there was even a motion in the Knesset years ago, about 20 years ago, somebody put a motion in the Knesset to excise Sefer Yoshua from the Bible, which led to a major response of the various religious sectors, I don't need to tell you, including a public lecture series that was given in Shivat HaRetzion in direct response to that motion to address the issue of Musar v'Kibush and the ethical foundation of Sefer Yeshua, a day which ultimately was, in a sense, the prelude to what had become the Yimei Yom B'Tanach in the Gush today. So, it is the major, major issue. And just to understand this parak of, or this part of Chumash, I'm going to give you this source page. In case I'm pass it down. If you look at the way I've outlined, or the way I've copied over this perek at the beginning of the page, you see essentially that the Torah describes the battle, the mechanism and the methodology of war in two paragraphs. The first paragraph being referring to Shaar Amim, and the second paragraph referring to Amei Kanaan. So with regards to nations that are far away, that's the right-hand box. All of those people, from Pasuk Yud to Pasuk Tetvav, ki tikrav al yoli lachem alea, v'karata alea l'shalom, v'ayayim shalom tanelach ufatchalach v'yakol ha'am ashin timtza bo yulach alamas v'avaducha. Obviously, that's different than Lo Techayya Kol Neshama. Hayalacha, first of all, it says, B'karata Alea L'Shalom. First, there's a call to peace. And if they accept your peace overture, then the result is the local population, Vayulacha Lemas V'Avaducha. Avaducha meaning you're the sovereign nation, mass, tribute, taxes. I can live with that. If they don't make shalom and they make war, right, then if it's milchama, then there's a siege and there is zechura lefichareb, there is the males by the sword, the soldiers, the combatants. As for the nashim, the taf, and the bizah, as for the spoils of war, that's all fair game. And I have the flip side, which is, expression for expression. First of all, when it comes to Amei Kanaan,
rak mi'arei amim ha'el asher Hashem
elokecha neten lecha nachala, there's no reference to an overture of peace. Correct? Because how can you make peace with them? Make none, you have to destroy. Lo techayeh kol neshama.
Lo techayeh kol neshama.
I thought you could do some kind of...
Hold it. Hold on a second. Okay, we're just working right now on the text. And we're going to get to what you're going to get to in a second. Ayulach alamasa v'aducha doesn't apply because, right, you can't take people who aren't alive and make them masva v'aducha. That doesn't work. There's no siege because you're not capturing anybody, you are destroying. There's no distinction between male and female because ultimately, clear? Two very different worlds based on distinction of what? What's the criteria?
Remote cities and local.
Remote cities and Mekna. This is local, this is foreign. Where would you put Amalek? Where would you put Amalek?
Sounds like Amalek.
I think that would go without saying.
Yeah.
Amekna would include Amalek.
Yeah.
Everybody with me so far?
It would include them.
It doesn't say the nations, but there's
subcategories
of some of those. So those are broad categories of nations. Yeah.
Okay. Anyway, Amalek doesn't have a place. They don't have a city.
They're not nomadic. They don't have a specific region, but they're
wandering in the desert.
I still have this command, Temched Zecha Amalek, to add to the Amei Kanaan. So you combine them together, and Shaul comes and he's told, Timched Hacharim Tem, Hacharim Tacharimem. The phraseology is close enough that clearly he's given a mandate to include Amalek amongst the Amekna.
But But Amalek's crimes are spelled out. The crimes of Amalekanon are not.
They are, in a sense, they're just not spelled out here. Uh-huh. The morality of idolatry, or the immorality of idolatry, is this whole different subject altogether.
Right.
Their crime is that they're idolatrous cultures that need to be removed from the land of Israel, which has to become an idolatry-free zone. There is more to idolatry than a theology. Idolatry is inherently an immoral culture. Child sacrifice, virgin rape, all kinds of morality issues that undermine, that are part of the world of idolatry. It's very hard to understand the Torah's battle against idolatry without realizing or taking into account that inherent, embedded in the culture of idolatry was an immoral culture. Molech, child sacrifice, Baal was a fertility rite and sexually immoral. There were all kinds of moral issues related to idolatry, and it's very, I believe, that part of the Torah's war against idolatry is not because that they believed in a pantheon of gods, but because it was inherently a culture that, at its very core, was immoral. And therefore banned. Now, however, this is very nice. This is very nice, and this distinction works, at least us with a moral plague on our conscience. But it's very nice. The problem is, it's not correct, at least not halachically. And so now, when we get into the halachic sources of Torah Shebaal Peh and how Torah Shebaal Peh understood the halacha of Kibush Haaretz, suddenly all of this takes on a much more complicated world.
In this version, straight from Sukkim, the Amekanan, you could not take Bizai, you couldn't.
Nope. It doesn't sound like you could take Bizan. It doesn't sound like you could leave any soul alive.
Well, it says literally, "Lo techei kol neshama." So nobody can.
Yeah, it doesn't say much about the spoils.
Spoils.
Right. It doesn't say much about the spoils. It's much more about the people than about the spoils. That's true. So where does our story begin? Our story begins on the source page.
Emily. Geographically, didn't belong to Eretz Israel.
They're in the south. They're in the south. They're in the Negev.
On territory that was going to become part of.
Yeah,
the
they're in the they're in the Negev area. But again, the issue with Amalek is that they're nomadic and they're behavioral issues. In other words, the issue with Amalek is not a territorial one. It's the fact that they keep attacking and raiding our cities. And capturing our women and children, so there's a different battle plan with Amalek. The fact that they're nomadic is an issue we'll come back to eventually when we learn the story. But now we're going to leave. Remember, there's an Ir Amalek. Shaul attacks Ir Amalek. They have a melech. So, as much as we can describe them as nomadic, nomadic tribes don't usually have a capital city and a king. So we have to balance that too. Says the Yerushalmi, Amar Rabbi Shmuel Bar Nachman, Shalosh Parstigiot, Shilach Yehoshua le'Eretz Yisrael Ad Shelo Yikansu le'Aretz. Anybody here know what a parstig is? Or parstigia? So,
ambassador,
message. So some sort of message. Typically related to as a letter. He sent three letters or three messages that he sent via some vehicle, most likely in writing, to the Amekna'an in advance of entering the land of Israel. So says the Yerushalmi, Sechet Shvi'it, that before Yeshua steps foot in the land of Israel, he sent three letters, meaning three options. And they said the following. Mishu rotze lahafnot ifne. Anybody wants to leave now, leave. Lehashlim yashlim. Anybody wants to make peace, you're welcome to do so. Lasot milchama yaseh. And if you want to fight us, go ahead. Here are your three options. fight, flee, or
surrender,
or make peace. Lashlim. Which means you accept your sovereignty in the land, and you accept an idolatry-free zone in the land of Israel, which means, in Estam, it includes an abandonment of the culture of idolatry. Those are the terms. Now, before we even go any further, you ask me, what's the problem with this statement?
Because the Torah says otherwise.
Right. We're talking about Amei Canaan. We're not talking about faraway nations. We're not talking about faraway cities. We're talking about Amei Canaan. And the Gemara states clearly that Yeshua offered them an option of peace. That's what it says. Not only that, it says that they responded, different nations responded differently. Girgashi pina, Girgashi ran away, which is why Girgashi appears in some of the sources and not on the other sources. When it lists the Meknan, so says Rashi. Givonim hishlimu, the Givonim made peace with us. Now, do you remember the story of the Givonim? They were that little tribe that lived in the area of Givon, which is a city northwest of Yerushalayim, today in the area of Telstone, that were afraid of Yeshua and the army, so they were afraid that they would be mistaken as Canaanites and therefore be obliterated. So what did they do? Right. They disguised themselves as if they came from a faraway land. They wore worn-out clothes. They took dry bread and empty canteens. They showed up at Yeshua's door saying, we've come from a long journey, 6 weeks to get here, right? We want to make peace with you. And the elders say, hey, go for it. We'll make you a peace treaty with you. What do we have to lose? And then they discover that they're 10 kilometers away. So one of the questions with the Givonim is, if they were in fact allowed to make peace, then why did they have to disguise themselves? The Rambam asks that question and suggests that initially they did not make peace, and they thought that once that option was refused, it was off the table. They never realized that it was always on the table, and any nation of Canaan could make peace with us at any time. And so it was a ruse based on an error of judgment on their part. And really unnecessary. Okay, park it for a second. And thirdly, 31 kings waged war with us. They refused to take either of the other two options. You understand the problem here? It says, how do you have an option of lashlim? Just off the bat. And the Gemara doesn't ask that question. Nowhere in this Gemara does it ever say, wait a second, but it says, Lo tachayek kol neshama. How can you say that? The Gemara takes it as a given that the offer of shalom is relevant to the Mekanan and brings psukim to demonstrate that from Sefer Yoshua. Now I'll take it one step further. Take a look at the Rambam. Source 2 and 3. Now, one word about the Rambam in these laws, Hilchot Malachim, Malachim b'Melchama, is that the Shulchan Aruch does not include in the laws of the Shulchan Aruch any laws pertaining to an aspect of Jewish practice that's not relevant b'zman, the writing of the Shulchan Aruch. Let me say that again. The Shulchan Aruch is a codification of all of Jewish law, but only that aspect of Jewish law that was relevant in practice in the 16th century when the Shulchan Aruch was written. So aspects, for example, of the laws of the Beit HaMikdash, or the laws of Korbanot, or the laws of Jewish kings, or Jewish army, these things didn't exist in the 16th century. They weren't relevant. Some of them are still not relevant. And therefore the Shulchan Aruch is silent on all those aspects of Allah. The Rambam, the fundamental difference between the writing of the Shulchan Aruch and the Rambam, is that the Rambam includes the totality of halacha as it appears in the Gemara in his codification process. Therefore, there's a general consensus amongst poskim that for the most part, there are some exceptions, but for the most part, any matter of halacha that the Shulchan Aruch is silent on, we paskin like the Rambam. That's very important to understand. They can't fall back on, must be a machloket, there's another opinion out there. Halacha, we pass on like the Rambam. And the Rambam states the following. Ein ha-melech nilcham tchila ela milchemet mitzvah. We're familiar with the distinction between a Mechamet Mitzvah and a Mechamet Rishut. Mechamet Mitzvah is an obligatory war. Mechamet Rishut is an optional war. Logically, it stands to reason that a king of Israel is not authorized to go and fight optional wars and campaigns before they have completed the obligatory ones. Agreed? What defines a Mechamet Mitzvah? Eizohi Mechamet Mitzvah, says the Rambam, Zu Mechamet Shiva Amamim U Mechamet Amalek. Ve'ezrat Yisrael Miyad Tzar Sheba Aleihem. There are three definitions of a Mechamet Mitzvah. One is a war against the Sheva Amekna'an. Two, a war against Amalek, even though it's not listed amongst the seven Amekna'an, but it falls into the category of a Mechamet Mitzvah, and therefore generally subsumed under the same rules. And thirdly, any war of self-defense. Mechamet Yisrael Miyad Tzar Sheba Aleihem. That's enormously important because according to most poskim, it places the context of today's army, the IDF, the Army of Israel, in the category of a Mechamet Mitzvah, because it defines the Mechamet Mitzvah to include any war of self-defense. That has enormous ramifications. Ramifications for the draft, ramifications for... I argue you have to have a melech, so they argue that Jewish government has Jewish sovereignty and Jewish government has the status of Malchut. There was much more to be said about that, but on the face of it, that's the fundamental issue. Then the Rambam continues and says, V'yachakach nilcham b'milchemet harashut, v'hiya mechamash nilcham im shar ha'amim k'den l'harachiv gavu Yisrael. What's a mechamet reshut? Mechamet reshut is any war with other nations. Why would you be fighting other nations? Didn't ask that question before. The Torah presents two types of wars, one against Shiva Amekna'an and the other against Amim HaRuchokot. Why would you be fighting against Amim HaRuchokot? Because you want to expand the territory. Let's say you want to expand the land of Israel into a broader context. Malchut David, right? David's kingdom is much larger than the boundaries of the land of Israel. Right? Because at some point or another, David led campaigns, military campaigns, to expand the boundaries of Israel, especially into Syria, and expanded the territory. That's what the Gemara refers to as Kibush Surya. So, good question. We'll subject to explore later. Now, that just defines, for our purposes, defines the war with Amalek as part of Mechamet Mitzvah. Source 3. Ein osin milchama im adam ba'olam ad shekorin lo shalom. Says the Rambam, there is no such thing as any war with any nation without first extending a hand of peace. Echad milchemet harashut ve'echad milchemet mitzvah. That applies whether the war is a milchemet reshut or a milchemet mitzvah. Shene'ema, what psukim does he quote to prove this? The very same psukim we just read. Now, challenge me for a minute. That's very, textually, that's very problematic. Why?
It could be a bad verse is just...
Wait, don't give me resolutions yet. First give me the challenge. Challenge the rest of the Rambam.
He didn't say it in the text.
It does say in the text.
It's the opposite in the text. The
why?
The implication is the opposite.
Because the pasuk, Vaya, ki tikra ve'li ali lechem alea,
is for
Shar Ha'amim. It's not for a Meknan. For a Meknan, it says, lo techeya kon neshama. That's how we read, ki tikra ve'li ali lechem alea, ve'karat alea l'shalom, kein tasel lo kol ha'arim ha'rechokot, when it comes to a Meknan, lo techeya kon neshama. So what has the Rambam done? It's taken a verse out of the first context and applied it to Meknan. Okay, we'll have a resolution to that, but understand that that's the problem here. Im ishlimu v'kiblu sheva mitzvot shenitztavu b'nei Noach, if they make peace, and here the Rambam stipulates the criteria for peace, they have to accept sheva mitzvot b'nei Noach, one of which, of course, is thou shalt not kill, another one of which is thou shalt believe in one God, meaning to abandon idolatry, pagan idolatry. A third of which is to establish courts and a moral system of judgment and law. Well, Shiva Miknat, the Shiva Mitzvah Bnei Noach. En horgin me'en neshama. Then nobody, then you may not kill a single one. They'll pay tribute, they'll pay taxes. Shenema, yilecha lamas, avaducha. But im lo ishlimu, if they don't make peace, o sheishlimu v'lo kiblu sheva mitzvot, or they want to make peace on their terms, meaning without accepting the sheva mitzvot b'nei Noach, then l'sinim v'emuchama, then you can make war with them. Now the Rambam distinguishes. And Halacha Dalet, he says the following. V'orgin kol azcharim agdolim u'bozuzim kol mamonam betapam. Then you can kill the older ones, right? The zecharim agdolim, whereas the women and children are part of the bizav. En orgin isha v'lo katan, right? Women and children not. Shenemar v'anashim v'ataf shel zecharim b'med v'mamurim. When is that true? B'mechamet harashot. That's true for optional war. Shuim shah umot. Aval shiva amamim v'amalek. Here he says it explicitly. The seven mitzvot, the seven meknan, and amalek. If they don't make peace, ein menechim mehem neshama, because it says lo tachaya kol neshama. V'cheinu amet imched zecher amalek. And then he says, how do I know that every nation, even Amalek, could make peace? And he quotes Pesukim. You understand the problem here. What I've just suggested, if you ask most people, Jews today, go up to anybody who's ever basic knowledge of Chumash and Rashi and Midrashim, and you ask them to understand the nature of Amalek, they will tell you that the Torah's obligation of Amalek, vis-a-vis Amalek, is to destroy Amalek. Every man, woman, and children, sight unseen, right? If you see a newborn child of Amalek, you kill them, because that's what you're supposed to do. Hanech deketot. It's a myth. It's a total myth. The Rambam says explicitly that for every nation, including Amalek, you cannot lift a finger in war until first offered them peace. Then we can talk about what happens next. It's a remarkable statement. It's a remarkable statement. Everybody agrees with it. It's in the Rambam. There's no options here. There's no options here. This is not negotiable. This is the Rambam based on the Gemara and the Yerushalmi in Masechet Shvi'it. Nobody argues. Mm-hmm. Now, I have a problem. Mm-hmm. That's to be determined. It could be that it was done in the days of Yoshua, and it applied, right? And then the Amalek's wars over the years were demonstrations that they, right, once they refused, once you start the war, then it's a different ballgame, ostensibly.
But then also the original Amalek doesn't exist today. That's also...
It's a separate issue. It's almost a convenient excuse, right? It's almost a convenient out. You don't have to worry about Amalek because they don't exist anymore. But it's an answer of convenience rather than of substance. So what do I do here? So David is correct. The only way to resolve the text in the way the Rambam understands it is to pick up on a nuance that the Rambam has suggested. So now, David, you want to clarify what you were going to say before?
He chops the first column into two. He says
correct.
The first column starts out for both cases, and then
right. The first couple of psukim, says the Rambam, is relevant to both parshu. And the way you have to read this parak, therefore, is as follows. I'm going to give you a schematic outline, and then I'm going to give you a page with the actual text on it, so you don't have to copy it down. I'm going to literally give it to you spelled out. But essentially, the parsha begins with a opening statement that is generic to all war. Ki tikrav El ir lehilachem aleh. Any war. What do you do? The first thing is v'karat aleh l'shalom. Without exception. V'ya im shalom, and if they answer with peace. Okay, if they answer with peace. Then what? Which the Rambam understands to mean to include Sheva Mitzvot B'nei Noach. not in the text, but let's take that as a given. And if not, im the milchama, if they open up to war, then, now, remember, Torah is written linearly, so if they respond and say, no, we want war, then it depends who you're fighting. If you're fighting Arim Ruchokot, then the next step is Bitsarta Aleh, to wage war by siege. Which includes fighting the Zacharim, Hagadolim, which includes the notion of Nashim B'Taf as part of the Bizah. We're going to talk about that momentarily.
The siege to encourage them to make peace.
We're going to talk about that in a second. Maybe. But there may be other options there too. In a second, all the concept of the siege for a second, we're going to get to it. And with regards to a meknan, what does it say? Whereas, Rak mi'arei amim asher Hashem alakach anaten lecha nachala, there, lo techaye kol
Hashem. That's once you start the war.
Okay. Which means, now, I'll give you this. Okay. So once you've looked at the text from the Rambam's vantage point, meaning, or the Gemara's vantage point, Ki tikrav alili lechem alev ekvat alel l'shalom is a universal statement. V'yayim shalom ta'ancha ufatchalach v'yay kol ha'am an mitzah b'chiyulach ha'lamas v'avaducha. And therefore they can always make peace and they can always accept Jewish sovereignty. V'im lo, and if not, im lo tashlim imach. V'yastayim cha mechama, they're going to make war, then we're going to break it up. Option one, which is Mechemet Rishut, Vitzarta Aleh, siege, which includes Viketakol Zchora, the Nashim Betaf will be part of the Biza, and that's relevant to faraway nations. Whereas of the nations that are in your midst, Me'arei Ha'amim Ha'eleh, Lo Techaya Kol Neshama, Ki Acharem Tachamimem, they must be destroyed, Achiti V'Amori V'Aknani V'Aprizi V'Achivi V'Aivosi. Why? So Torah says why? Correct. There's a why. The why is very important. Lema'an asher lo yalamdu etchem lasot et kol ha'tovavatam.
Does it say that the other nations didn't have those
targets? No, but they're irrelevant because they're far away. So they're not going to be a cultural influence on you because, like, you know, 1,000 miles away. Who cares? They'll pay tax. What do I care? But the nations in your midst, if you allow their pagan idolatrous cultures to exist in your name, right? Look at Sefer Malachim, right? Look at Sefer Shoftim. This was borne out time and time again. You allow the idolatry to remain intact, and you're gonna have a problem.
Does the Rambam explain it this way? Does he say this is how you should read the psukim, or does someone interpret how he?
Well, the Rambam uses these psukim to describe Mechemet Mitzvah and Mechemet Rishut. He says these psukim are included in Halacha Aleph, and these psukim are included in his distinction in Halacha Dalet. So there's really no way to understand the Rambam other way, other than this. So Ad Kan, I've shared with you what I think the Rambam would see as pshat in the text. From here to the end of the shiur, which is the next 10 minutes, I'm going to share with you what I think is conjecture, but it's a thesis put forward by Rav Yoel Ben Nun, by Rav Medan, by some of the Mordechai Breuer, by many of the Tanakh scholars of our generation today. And I think there's a lot of truth to it textually. Just, it's a hard concept to swallow or to understand. So, but we're gonna work it through. Essentially, what the Torah is describing are two different kinds of wars against two different sets of nations, one local, one foreign. The terminology the Torah uses is very intentional, but not necessarily precise. It's very intentional, not necessarily literal.
But you mean, when you say not precise, you mean there's a range of options that you can work with?
Meaning that the Torah is talking in terms that are almost code, almost generalization. Essentially, the Torah describes two different methodologies of war. This methodology and this methodology are completely different methodologies. Forget for a moment who the war is against, either in terms of nation or in terms of combatants versus non-combatants. Forget that for a second. Just from the perspective of the methodology of war. You go to war against a foreign nation, a foreign city, somewhere far away. You're going to take Nashim, Vataf, and Bizar. You're going to take spoils of war. You're going to take women and children. You're going to fight this Zakhor. What's the key word in this side of the board? Bitzarta. Otherwise known as a matzor. A matzor is a siege. A siege war is fundamentally different from a direct frontal attack. If you think about the Sefer Yehoshua, I don't know if you remember from your last time you read through Sefer Yehoshua, but if you think about Sefer Yehoshua, when did Israel ever engage in a siege war? There's only one in all of Sefer Yehoshua, and it lasts a total of 7 days. Right. And the siege was to bring the wall down, and it was only 7 days. That's not a real siege. A real siege is you starve the population out, takes years, and the purpose is so that you enter without having to fight the population. Why would you enter without having to fight the population?
Because they all died of hunger or too weak to fight.
They're too weak to fight, and therefore, once you enter in after they've...
You conquer easily,
and then what do you do?
Take over their city. You don't have to destroy
the city. Take over the city. You don't have to destroy the city. And more importantly, what do you do with the population?
They give you tribute.
Okay, tribute or...
Subjugate them.
You control them. You now are... They are now your servants, your slaves. It's a very different methodology to a methodology that says, okay, here's the army attack. When Yehoshua was fighting the nations of Canaan, come back to Sefer Yehoshua over and over and over again, Yehoshua has a constant challenge. He has two major challenges. This is from the strategic standpoint of Sefer Yehoshua. There are two major challenges that Yeshua constantly struggles against. One is that all the cities are walled cities. And Yeshua does not want to fight a long, prolonged siege war. It's absolutely the last thing Yeshua ever wants to do. Partially because the Torah commands him not to. Lo techayekon neshma, I'm arguing, is not a literal phrase that means you kill every man, woman, and child. It's a phrase that describes a methodology of battle that stands in contrast to Vitzartale. And I'll prove this to you momentarily from the text. Yehoshua, for example, is fighting every walled city, but he never besieges the cities. The exception of Yericho, and there he's commanded to by a Navi, by the Malach, for the very purpose of bringing the wall down so that he doesn't have to siege the city and he can go in and attack the city directly. There are no siege wars that Yehoshua conducts. Why? Because the purpose of a siege war is to capture and subjugate the nations that you conquer.
It takes too long.
Well, it takes too long, but more importantly, the last thing in the world the Torah wants is for every Israelite nation to have as slaves and servants pagan Canaanite people that have been conquered by siege and subjugated.
Too much influence.
Too much influence. It's exactly the point. That's why there's no reference in this left-hand column to any kind of bizarre of spoils, of certainly not of human spoils, of women and children. Meaning it's a methodology that existed in ancient battles. It was either a siege war whose purpose was to capture the subjugated population, or it was a direct war which was to come to a decisive victory. But think about it for a second. Let's assume you conducted a direct war and you came to a decisive victory. You fought the army and you came to a decisive victory and the army surrendered. for a moment, in the army of your enemy, let's say the Girgashi, the Chivi, the Knani, the Amorite, whatever nation it was, the moment they surrendered, what falls into place?
It's an option for shalom.
Correct. So you'll never, ever reach a point where you obliterate every man, woman, and child, because the moment the army surrenders, you're back to here. It's a direct contradiction. And what I'm suggesting is that the terminology of Lot HaChayekon Neshama, while intentional in terms of the contrast to a methodology of a siege war, is not literal. It's a code to describe two different kinds of battle. A battle of a frontal attack whose purpose is to come to a decisive military victory on the battlefield. Yeshua strategically is to draw the nations out of the walls. Yeshua is fighting the clock. He doesn't want the nations of Canaan to unite. And he's fighting the walled cities. And so he's constantly drawing the enemy out into open fields and open arenas where he has an equal playing field. He never besieges the cities. Because that's a different methodology. It takes longer. Yeshua doesn't have the time. The Torah prohibits it. Because the purpose of the war is not to take captives of the Canaanites, but to create an idolatry-free zone in the land of Israel. If the nations surrendered and accept the laws of Noach and the laws of an idolatry-free zone, then the war is over. They stop being a Meknan, essentially. So you're never going to reach that point of Lo Tachayek on the Shema, because they'll surrender beforehand, and then the war is over. Now I'll show you an example. Take a look on the source page. Go back to the source page.
This is Rav Yoel Ben Nun.
This is, I heard it from Rav Meidan. Oh. I suspect it's actually written up by an article by Rav Meidan. I suspect that they both
authored it.
They both subscribe to it. It's always hard to distinguish what Chiddush belongs to whom, because they kind of write in contempt, you know, sort of parallel to each other. Mm-hmm. Source 4. Here's a pasuk out of Sefer Yoshua. Just to add a phrase to our list of phrases of destruction. List of phrases that are used to describe total destruction. Here's the pasuk in Yoshua. Az Allah Haram Melech Gezer, the king of Gezer came to attack Yoshua, to assist Lachish, Lazoret Lachish. Vayakeo Yoshua v'et amo ad bilti hishir lo sarid. Yoshua fought him and his people until there was no remnant left. Translate that phrase. Explain that phrase. What does it mean that Yoshua fought them until there was no remnant left? Do you think that fits into the phraseology of lo tachayeh kol neshama, hacharem tacharimem, me'ish v'yad isha, does it fit that genre of terminology?
Yeah.
I think that's a fair assessment.
Yeah.
We could add this to the list. Le'ishilo sarit, not a remnant. Yeshua Perek Tet Zayin, source 5, lists in Perek Tet Zayin all of the cities that Israel never settled. Conquered, but territories that remained Canaanite strongholds, and therefore Israel never was able to settle in those regions. Remember, that's part of the issue of Sefer Yeshua, that they don't finish the job. V'lo hirishu et ha-Kna'ani ha-yoshev ba-gezer, v'yeshev ha-Kna'ani bekerev Ephraim ad ha-yom hazeh v'yilem ha-soved. Or source 6, in Shoftim Perek Aleph, v'Ephraim lo hirishu et ha-Kna'ani ha-yoshev ba-gezer, v'yeshev ha-Kna'ani bekerbo ba-gezer. So I'm confused. The Canaanites in Gezer, and because they're Canaanites in Gezer, Israel never is able to conquer, to settle in the area of Gezer. And yet, it says that Yeshua conquered Gezer, or conquered the king of Gezer, and his entire people, v'lo yishir lo sarid, without leaving a remnant behind. So did he kill every man, woman, and child, or didn't he? You follow the problem? I have a phrase that fits exactly into this context. Yeshua did what he was commanded to do, lo yishir lo sarid. And yet, they're Canaanites in Gezer. Clearly, it says so. The flip side, What is the nature of a siege war? How does a siege war look like in Tanakh? So we have a few examples of what a matzor looks like in Tanakh. Mostly because we were on the receiving end of siege wars several times in Tanakh. The most famous, of course, is the last siege of Yerushalayim, but the Assyrians and then the Babylonians, actually the Assyrians besieged the Shomron twice. And if you take a look at source 8, this is a description of the siege of the Shomron. Ve'yetzu narei sarei medinot berishona. Vayashlech Ben-Hadad. Ben-Hadad is the king of Aram, or king of, and he sends his people, and he says to them, "Egidul lemor anashim yatzu mishomron." There are people from Shomron who have come out of the siege, who have emerged from the siege. So Ben-Hadad says to his soldiers the following: these people who have come out of the city, what's the immediate? If you're the general and you're besieged a city for 3 years, and now there are people beginning to come out of the city, what are you considering? What are your options? What are they coming to do? What do you think they're coming to do?
Surrender.
Either coming to surrender or
fight a
last-ditch battle. Those are only two options, right?
Mm-hmm.
Says Ben-Hadad, listen to very carefully, because it's the foundation of what a siege war is about. Vayomer. Im l'shalom yatzao, if they've come out because they seek peace, tifsum chayim, capture them alive. V'im l'milchama yatzao, but if they've come out to wage war, chayim tifsum, then alive capture them. Meaning, either way, I want them alive. Why?
Hostages, maybe?
Subjugation. It does not. If you've besieged a city for 3 years, it serves you no purpose to kill the population. Your goal is to enslave the population. Your goal is to subjugate them. Your goal is to establish your territorial sovereignty over them. It serves you no purpose to kill them.
But they'll influence you.
Again, this is Ben-Hadad. This is the philosophy of siege of the nations of the world. They're talking about Israel. The Torah's vantage point is that's precisely the kind of war the Torah prohibits. That's the methodology that the Torah did not want Israel to engage in a siege war and subjugation of the idolatrous cultures of Canaan. There were only really two options. If they were not prepared to put down the idolatry, then you were going to force them to do it. But idolatry had to be cleaned from the land of Israel. Idolatry was inherently an immoral culture, a very enticing immoral culture, and the land of Israel was to essentially become a idolatry-free zone. But leaving aside that question, whether the Torah had the right, whether we had the right to impose that, that's a separate question. Modern wars have been fought over far less offensive moral issues than was the morality of idolatry. The foundation here is the suggestion that the Torah never really means to fight a war in which every non-combatant is a fair target. The Torah's terminology is to distinguish between two types of battlefields. A siege war, where your purpose is to capture and enslave or subjugate the population, versus a frontal war, where your purpose is to come to a decisive victory and then set the terms of victory. But it's not about who you kill, it's about the nature of the army. And that applies to Amalek too. And that's the big finish. That's where you can have survivors, because it's not about genocide, to put it into, to use a modern term. It's about coming to a decisive military victory that allows you to set the terms of what it means to remain in the land of Israel.
So to this day, the modern state of Israel doesn't know what to do with its captives.
Correct. It's a moral issue. It's a major moral issue. But in the it's complicated today because of international levinas and international law. But in the biblical context, it was simpler. You have a defined boundary in which the Torah has established the territory for the Jewish people, with the understanding that nations are allowed to stay there as citizens of your territory. We call a ger toshav. The only criteria for a ger toshav is that they have to accept Jewish sovereignty and they have to accept the sheva mitzvot bnei noach, which is essentially a moral code. The difference between sheva mitzvot bnei noach and idolatry is morality. That's the foundation of it. So, in this context, in this arena, when we look at the bottle of Amalek, or the mandate to Amalek, the terminology to Sha'ul is borrowed from the Torah's terminology. I'm going to argue, therefore, that at no time was the mandate, in fact, to kill every man, woman, and child, but to engage Sha'ul in a Amalek in a decisive, once and for all, military victory would end the threat of Amalek for generations.
Then why does the Torah use that terminology?
It's very confusing. It is confusing. It's not precise, but it stands in distinction to this concept, which was the relevant practice of warfare in the ancient world, which is siege war for the purpose of subjugation and enslavement. And that's what the Torah is fighting against. And along the same lines that you said earlier about the Torah's attitude towards slavery, the Torah did not want this kind of war. And so it flips it, albeit to an extreme, but I'm suggesting that based on all the sources that...
What was the difference, though, in terms of a siege and a full frontal
victory? The purpose of
victory?
A siege was a long-term subjugation for the purpose of enslaving or subjugating the local population.
But even if you did it that way, eventually you defeat the town, and you say the terms and conditions are that you must.
You still have the culture intact and the influence over generations that are there. Look at the example of Shlomo Melech. Shlomo Melech, who marries 1,000 political wives, and at the end of his life, when he's an older man, he can't control the cultural influence of all of those wives.
But a decisive victory, you set the terms.
Yeah, because essentially, for all intents and purposes, you wipe out the male population. The female population will integrate. And you destroy the culture.
They could be the ones who are the carriers of the culture anyway. That's the Shlomo example.
Yeah, but those were queens. Not quite. Generally speaking, it was more effective at sort of integrating into. Because he became Israelites. Imagine the case of Eshet Yifator. Become part of the Israeli culture and they marry.
Seems like it's not always a given that would be the
case. No, but in terms of extremes, that's the goal. I mean, that's the picture the Torah presents are two different methodologies because they end up in two different places. That's the sort of the
end. So a siege would end up with people, with men and women still remaining alive and being
and still remaining culturally connected,
committed to their
right.
Whatever idolatrous culture.
So Sha'ul's error was in keeping one person alive.
We have not gone back to Sha'ul.
Okay.
We have a long way to go before we get back to Sha'ul. We've already demonstrated 2 weeks ago that clearly his mistake could not have been just by leaving one person alive, because where are all the soldiers coming from? So we have what to do. But there's a lot of Shem to be continued.